MacCast, Monday, March 17th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I've got another special show for you this time around. We're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to cover a little bit of news and rumors and things like that, some of the latest stories that have been going on. But really, once again, we're in kind of one of those lull points while we're waiting for Apple to actually do something, to bring out a new product. There's hints of maybe some updates coming, things like that. But really, a lot of rumors, a lot of speculation. iPhone 6 rumors, rumors of what the next version of iOS is going to look like. Apple TV, what's happening with that. Also, we're going to take a look at maybe some products that were rumored, but may not be coming at least anytime this year. And also, a couple of products, one being switched up a little bit, another one maybe coming back from the grave. So we will get into all of those stories. Plus, I have another interview for you, another Meet a Member of the Mac Community kind of episode. First one we did, we had Brett Terpstra on. That was a lot of fun, and I want to do some more of these. And so this time around, I was able to get a guy, I've actually been on his podcast a few times, Irfan Elijah from Cult of Mac, who hosts the Cultcast. And he has a pretty interesting background and sort of transition into becoming a member of the Cult of Mac team. So we're going to get into that story, find a little bit more about him in an interview in the back half of the show. And it was a lot of fun, one of the more fun interviews that I've done in a while. So I hope you enjoy that and stay tuned for that. But before we get started, before we get into all this stuff, let me take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know what I really like about the Gazelle? That the big thing about Gazelle is that it is so simple. They take something that normally for me would be painful, something I don't enjoy, and that is selling my old stuff, getting cash for my old stuff, my old iPhones, my old iPads. Very often I will try to hand those things down, but lately my friends and family, they all have new stuff. They don't want my old stuff. So I don't like dealing with online classifieds and private sales and all those sorts of things. Gazelle takes all the hassle out of getting cash for your old stuff. And it helps me offset some of the costs of those new devices. And the reason it's so easy is because they just walk you through the whole process. Their website, you go on there, you do a quick search, you go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, you look for your item, tell them which iPhone you have, which iPad you have, answer a few questions about the condition, whether you have accessories. They'll even buy broken stuff, so don't worry if it's got broken glass or something's wrong with it, they will buy the broken stuff. And then right there, they give you a risk-free trial offer. They say, here's what we'll give you for it, take it or leave it. And if you decide to take it, they cover the shipping. In some cases, they'll even send you a box. I did that last time I had to send in some iPhones. They sent me the box. All the shipping was covered. All I had to do was take my devices, accessories, put them in the box, send them off to Gazelle. And then when they receive that item, they look it over, make sure it matches everything you told them about it. As long as it does, they will send you out your money. You can get paid by check, by PayPal, or even by Amazon gift card, which is how I prefer, because then you get 5% more on your offer. Plus, you can go spend that on Amazon. I'm an Amazon Prime member, and I love it. So it's a great way to get that money quickly and then be able to turn around and use it to buy new stuff. So fast payment, typically within days of getting the item received. They will even wipe your data. So if you're worried about sending it in, you've got all your old data on there, they'll wipe it off. But of course, you could do that yourself before you send it in. And they've paid out more than $100 million to more than 600,000 customers. So great service. I can't say enough about it. I want you to try it out. Go to gazelle.com today and do it now, because every day your items are going to lose value. So you want to take advantage of the best price that you can get. Do it sooner than later, gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. A lot of speculation going on suddenly about what the iPhone 6 is going to be, what it's going to look like, what kinds of features it's going to have. This week we heard from the Japanese blog Mac Takahara. They say that Apple actually has two final candidates for a potential iPhone 6. It sounds like the way they're spinning it is it will be one or the other, not necessarily both, although the difference really is screen size. We've known for a while that most people are saying Apple's going to go with a larger sized screen, something more in the 4.5 to 5.5 inch range. Mac Takahara is saying the two candidates are a 4.7 inch and a 5.7 inch display. As far as the design goes, they're saying the design actually looks kind of like a cross between iPhone 5C and an iPod Nano, although I kind of got the impression they meant more that iPod Touch, but all the reports I was reading said iPod Nano. Basically, having the button styling and the rounded back that you see on the iPhone 5C along with the colors, but the colors are not going to be in plastic because, you know, this is going to be a high-end phone, the iPhone 6. They're going to have it in aluminum, more like the iPod Nano colors. So that anodized aluminum or also the iPod Touch, right? And they say that the 5.7 inch model, the one Apple is looking at, is just 7 millimeters thick. That's about the same thickness as the iPad Air, if you're wondering how to picture that. But that if that were the case, it's so thin that they're actually going to have the eyesight kind of protrude a little bit in the bump. They just can't fit it in that thin of a profile. So it's going to be more like the iPod Touch in that case. And Mac Takahara has had a pretty good track record compared to some of the other sources when it comes to iPhone rumors. So I take their rumors with a little more credence than maybe some others. And then another guy that has a lot of credence and dropped a bombshell on Twitter today is Sonny Dixon. He's been a pretty reliable source for rumors in the past. He says that the new iPhone 6 is going to be just 0.22 inches thick or around 5.58 millimeters. So just under 6 millimeters in thinness, and that it will have what he's calling he says Apple's going to be calling an ultra retina screen. Yeah, that's actually the term supposedly that the marketing people are going to use for it, an ultra retina screen, which is going to have a pixel density of 389 pixels per inch. I think the current iPhone 5S is at 326, if memory serves me right. So almost, about 60 more pixels, a little more than 60 more pixels per inch in terms of the density. And he also says that it's going to feature a new A8 processor clocking in at 2.6 gigahertz. I'm assuming it's a 64-bit processor, just like the A7. But for comparison, the A7 that's in the iPhone 5S is currently clocked at 1.4 gigahertz. So you're looking at 1.2 more gigahertz on the clock speed. So that would be a significant boost in the processor performance. Some other rumors that we're hearing from other sources that it may have a bezel-free display or even a thinner bezel on the sides, possibly a little bit better camera. Some people are saying maybe 10 megapixel or higher, but really more rumors are sticking with that Apple is going to have the 8 megapixel camera, but maybe with some better technology in it, including stuff like optical image stabilization technology, which would be amazing in so small a profile device. But apparently they have a company that can provide that kind of optical image stabilization, also improved image processing, the chips, the software, all that sort of stuff being improved in this next generation. There's also some rumors saying that Apple's going to throw some more sensors in there, if they can pack more sensors into already what is a pretty sensor-filled phone. But in addition to the gyroscope and the compass and all that other good stuff, we're hearing reports that there might be a pressure sensor, a temperature sensor, and humidity sensors. All of those things would help, I would imagine, with stuff like weather. Also could be used maybe for some of those health kind of applications. Specifically, I would imagine pressure sensors could help with sort of elevation and altitude kinds of measurements. But there have been rumors that an iWatch could potentially be using things like optical sensors to measure heart rate and oxygen levels. And if you remember, Tim Cook was really hot on sensor technology when he was speaking at the last All Things D conference. He really was doubling down on his belief that sensors were going to be a big deal moving forward. And most of the rumors we're hearing are that Apple is working on some sort of fitness style device, or at least having fitness kind of functionality built into the rumored iWatch. So that's kind of the latest on the iPhone 6. Andy Hartgraves at Pacific Crest does think, though, that Apple might try to up the pricing on this next round of iPhones, that there could be about a $100 bump in the pricing. So starting at $399 US for a base model iPhone on contract, on a two-year contract with a carrier. So that would be a subsidized price. I hope in that case it's going to be a minimum 32 gigabytes, and we're not talking that for the 16 gigabyte model, but he really didn't say. He just felt that Apple is a premium brand and they could command, if they're moving to a larger display, another $100 on that premium price, and that us Apple fans would just go ahead and pay it, that we really wouldn't complain. I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't relish giving another $100 when competitive phones are going down in price. But I think you pointed out that the Galaxy Note 3 was priced at like $299 on contract, so Apple wouldn't be too far off the mark if you compare it to that larger phone. But that's an almost 6-inch phone, so I don't know if display factors into that sort of decision when people are buying devices. Frankly, I don't want a huge gigantophone. I've talked about that on the MacCast in the past. I think that 4.7 is going to be too big for me almost. And if Apple goes all the way up to a 5.7, forget it. I'll be sticking with my iPhone 5S, I'm pretty sure. I just don't want... I like to put my phone in my front pocket, and I see these people using these phones, and it just looks ridiculous to me. I don't know. I know a lot of you like them, and I hope, hopefully not offending anybody, but... man, those gigantophones look silly when people are using them. It looks like you're holding a tablet to your face. But regardless, the China Times is claiming that production on the new iPhone 6, regardless of its size, is going to be starting up at a new Pegatron facility in the second quarter of this year, with full production set to be in swing by the third quarter. That should get the iPhone ready in time for a fall release, which is when most people would be expecting it. Apple sticking on that fall release cycle, probably in that September, October time frame, we'll see the next iPhone. But don't worry, at least one reviewer doesn't even need to see the next iPhone to tell you how it's going to do. He's already declared it a complete and utter failure. This was a piece written by Avram Plitch over at Laptop. I have a link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com. I'm going to ask you not to click it. I just threw it in there for posterity. Don't go to the site. I think this guy doesn't deserve the traffic. So I'll summarize basically his six reasons for you, and then you can maybe take it to him on Twitter and let him know what you think of his predictions for the iPhone 6. But, I mean, how can you declare a rumored product, something that doesn't even exist, and all the specs are purely speculation? How can you declare it already to be a failure? Well, he tried, and here's how it goes. Basically, 8-megapixel camera, which is a rumor we're hearing a lot about. He says the competition has more. We've got 16, 21s, 41-megapixel cameras, and if Apple can't step up to the plate with more megapixels, then failure. You know, forget about optics, forget about image quality, because more is always better, apparently, right? Well, I'm not buying that one. Also, iPhone 5S has a puny battery, just 1560 milliamp hour battery. He said in his testing he got just under 6 hours of battery life in his real world tests, and then goes on to claim that the Samsung gets 11.5 hours for the Galaxy S5. Again, another product that doesn't exist in the marketplace yet, but we're going to go ahead and take Samsung's marketing figure on that one as fact. It does have a larger battery, 2600 milliamp hours by comparison, but it's not out for real-world testing. So what we do have is the Galaxy S4, which has a 2300 milliamp hour battery, and it did, in real-world battery tests, just about on par, or in some cases slightly worse, than the iPhone 5S battery. So a battery 1560 milliamp hours versus 2300 milliamp hour milliamp hours, and they're matching out. So I don't see how the S5 is going to, with just 300 more milliamp hours, really best the iPhone 5/6 by almost double the battery life. So not buying that one. Next thing he cites is the iPhone 6 not having NFC. Has anybody else noticed that pretty much, especially in the US, NFC is dead on arrival? I think there's a lot of other technologies that are going to push NFC out of the way. Let's talk about low energy Bluetooth or Bluetooth LE. I think that's a much more viable technology, and there's other ways to do payment systems. More on that later with respect to the iPhone, specifically with the iOS 8. He says there's not enough OS level sharing options, basically not being able to share to, say, Microsoft Drive natively or Tumblr or a lot of the other online services. Those services are generally built into the appropriate third-party apps, though. So if you have an app that needs to interface with Google Drive or Microsoft SkyDrive or whatever those things might be, the developer is going to go ahead and integrate that stuff. If you have an app that's appropriate to publish to Tumblr, then developers can build it in through the APIs that are already available. I don't think Apple needs to do that for every service at the OS level. So I don't see that as a real big deal breaker. He goes on to cite a weak keyboard as being another problem, that, you know, the swipe technology and some of the other alternate keyboard technologies that can be employed by the different handset manufacturers outside the Apple ecosystem are better. Recently, we had Flesky as an alternative keyboard on iOS. So they're building an API and allowing developers to build in alternative keyboards into their apps. Apple is not stopping that. He's talking specifically about the OS level keyboard. I just don't know that that makes that big of a difference, the on-screen keyboard thing. I think most people, if they need a better keyboard experience, they're going with a keyboard case, something like that. And there's plenty of options out and available for iPhones. And then lastly, he cites limited customization, meaning the widgets and icons and alternative app launchers and all those things that you can load on top of your Android devices that, in my opinion, just tend to drain the battery and bog down the device. And then when something goes wrong or is wonky, the users tend to blame the device and the operating system, not necessarily the customizations that they applied, because it just gets confusing. You don't realize that that the source of the problem. It's just, hey, my phone is suddenly getting a lot less battery life. What's wrong? Something must be wrong with this device. And that is just trouble that I think Apple doesn't want. And it's not good for the consumer either. So I don't buy any of these arguments as any reason for the iPhone 6 to fail. And as a matter of fact, I will predict that the iPhone 6 is going to sell like crazy when it's released. As a matter of fact, some other sources are saying it could be because of the larger screen, the device that starts to eat back into some of the Android handsets market share. That only time will tell. I think people are either Android users or iOS users. There's a little bit of crossover, but I don't think it matters too much in the long run. There's some other figures that matter a lot more, and again, we'll talk about those more in a second. Let's talk Apple TV rumors. There's a few of those floating around now. Most recently, we've been hearing that the next generation of Apple TV might have a camera built in. And this came because Apple Insider discovered this week that there were mentions of camera support in the latest Apple TV updates. The thought here is that Apple could add a camera, an eyesight camera, to the Apple TV, and then that could be used for a gesture-based control system. So rather than using a remote, you could use various gestures, waving your hand in the air, things like that, to actually control your Apple TV. I am personally thinking that if Apple is exploring camera technology integrated with an Apple TV, that this goes more in line with some of the more recent game rumors we've been hearing, things like Bluetooth game controller support, and that Apple is looking to bring games to the Apple TV. More so than using your body as a remote, I could see Apple integrating the kind of technology that they acquired from PrimeSense, which was the company that made the Xbox Kinect device, to help build in gaming controls that you can get up, you can move your body, you can interact and play with the game. That seems to make a lot more sense to me. And so I think this is more about a gaming controller than actually a remote control for your a gesture-based remote control for your Apple TV. And then on the just Apple making an HD television front, there was a little story that surfaced this week about some statements Steve Jobs supposedly made at an executive retreat where he said that Apple would never make an HD TV product or never make an Apple-branded television because he said, quote, TV is a terrible business. They don't turn over and the margins suck, meaning that people don't buy TVs all that often and the margins are razor thin. And as we know, Apple likes to have a nice hefty profit margin. So that's why under Steve Jobs, Apple maybe never did a television set. We do have to step back a little bit and say, well, it's the Tim Cook era now and Tim Cook is doing things a little bit differently. So the question is, how does Tim Cook feel about high-definition television and that being a viable product for Apple? And that we really don't know. My gut instinct is that Apple is playing around with some designs and some ideas, but really they don't have a viable product yet. The set-top box that they're doing works really well, is a nice price point. I think they make some good money on it. We know they've sold a ton of them, and it's added to their bottom line, and I think they're going to continue to go down that road, at least until they can get some of the content stuff figured out, and that will then play into maybe a future Apple television product. But they don't have a lot of extra space in their retail stores. There's a lot of reasons why Apple shouldn't do an HD TV, and very few, I think most people can point to, that say why they should. So I think that's going to sort of continue. And speaking on the Apple TV front, there was an update, a software update, iOS 6.1 for Apple TV, and it added an interesting new feature, the ability to actually recognize and configure AirPlay over Bluetooth. Basically, what it does is eliminates the need for using the Bonjour on the Wi-Fi network to actually do the auto discovery and configuration of the connection. It's still going to send the signal over peer-to-peer Wi-Fi, but sometimes that peer-to-peer handshake that happens over Bonjour is blocked in certain situations, specifically business corporate environments and education environments. So that means being able to do that handshake over Bluetooth, that's going to be a little bit easier where you've got those network blocks in place. So that's going to be a nice, or that is a nice little update for those environments. And we know that Apple has that sort of conference room mode where anybody can go into a conference room with an Apple TV connected to a display and do the whole AirPlay mirroring thing. So that'll make that whole process a lot easier. You can just discover over Bluetooth and then transmit to over AirPlay to the Apple TV. Let's talk a little bit about the iPad Pro. We've been hearing for months now that Apple is working on a larger version of the iPad, something in the 12 to 13 inch range, something that's supposedly supposed to merge the iPad with the MacBook Air into a single device, more targeted at content creation. Well, latest rumors have been pointing to the fact that that product might not see the light of day this year. And it's coming from some fairly reliable sources within our community, Ming Chai Kuo for one of them. Digitimes also came out this week and cited low yields of the sapphire glass displays at Apple's new facility in Arizona, but that I don't think plays into this. It seems a little bit questionable to me, because even if they were having yield issues, and that is something that Corning warned might happen, that Apple would have sort of higher costs and it's more difficult to create the sapphire glass. But everything we've heard to date has said that, that glass is destined for the iPhone, not for any new iPads. This would be much larger pieces that Apple would have to use, and I think they're solely focused on getting that glass display in the next generation iPhone, if anything, if it's going beyond just what their current usage is, which is the Touch ID sensors and the glass covers for their EyeSight cameras. I do think they're moving in that direction for the next generation iPhone, but probably not ready on the iPad yet. So sounding like we won't see a Pro iPad this year, I think more likely because I just don't think there's quite a market for it yet. I think Apple's selling a lot of MacBook Airs and they're doing really well, especially the 11-inch form factor. People really like those for productivity. Having the built-in keyboard, I think, is great. And for those who want to go the tablet route, I think a tablet combined with a Bluetooth keyboard case is getting most people by for now. I just think that the iPad Pro, if Apple puts it out now, it falls into this weird kind of middle ground, and I'm not really sure where the market is for it. And I think Apple might be feeling the same way until they can kind of figure out the workflow of a Pro tablet, something that would replace, say, the lower end MacBook Air, the 11-inch MacBook Air. I think they're not going to really release the product. And I'm not sure we have a use case for it yet. Maybe some of you have some ideas or are very interested in a larger tablet. I know that Samsung has some out on the market, and maybe some of you have played around with them, so I'd love to hear or get your opinion. When the iPhone 5C was announced, a number of people really felt that Apple did not go low enough on the pricing for that device, and time has proven, and a lot of reports have proven, that the iPhone 5C might not be selling as well as Apple had hoped. We've been seeing Apple do a lot of heavy online and print ad campaigns surrounding the 5C, and it seems like they're pushing the device a lot harder, trying to get it out into the market and into the hands of more people. Well, we're hearing rumors this week that Apple may be launching an 8-gigabyte version of the iPhone 5C. This supposedly was leaked in an email from O2 in Germany, although iMore also claims to have sources that say in the UK, there's locations that already have stock of the new device getting ready to sell it. So it could go on sale anytime. It appears to be priced, at least in Germany, about $90 US lower than the 16-gigabyte iPhone 5C. I assume in the US that would translate to about a $100 price drop, putting the base model in the free price range on contract. I think currently the 16-gigabyte model will run you about $99 US with a 2-year contract. So that would give Apple the free phone that I think many people were hoping the iPhone 5C would be. There are also rumors that Apple may be looking to bring back the iPad 4. 9to5 Mac said that some retailers already have stock of 16-gigabyte black and white Wi-Fi and LTE models ready to go on sale Tuesday. The thought here is that Apple's looking to replace the $399 US iPad 2 with the iPad 4 as their low-end entry-level offering. And that would also mean that Apple finally is going to have all of their iPads with lightning connectors. It'll get rid of the 30-pin once and for all. And frankly, this makes a lot of sense to me. I didn't understand why Apple kept the iPad 2 around and didn't go with the iPad 4. A lot of people said it was because of performance and compatibility with the education markets. I kind of bought that a little bit, but you know, I think Apple is one to always kind of try to be pushing forward, and it makes more sense that they would want all their devices to be universally standardized on the Lightning connector. So it sounds like come the time you hear this podcast, the iPad 2 may have been retired and replaced with an iPad 4. And then just one other comment that I mentioned earlier, when it comes to profit, Apple is crushing it. And in case there was any doubt, Asimco's Horace Dedu put out a new report. He pointed to it on his Twitter account, and it showed that Apple's global cell phone shipment volume is currently at about just under 10%. So of all the cell phones out there in the world, they ship just under 10% of them. But Apple has 35% share of the global cell phone revenue. So compared to their competitors, they get 35% of the revenue. But take it one step further, and Apple has over 60% of the global cell phone profits. So that's 60% of the profits with less than 10% of the total industry shipments. I'll give you a moment to let that sink in. That is a big deal. Market share may be nice, selling a lot of product might be nice, but money share, profit share, is what keeps your bottom line healthy. It's what keeps your R&D budget running so that you can make the next great product. It keeps your company healthy, and plus it makes your shareholders happy. All good things for a company to have. And I think Apple believes in that. And I think they're perfectly happy to have 10% of the market if they can have more than 50% of the profits. And I think they're going to continue to do that. As the article points out, that's a hard lead to hold on to. But Apple is certainly going to try to protect that more than they are going to worry about how many actual devices that they're selling. And I've said that for a long time, but it was just great to see that illustration of it in that report from a Simco. And then let's talk a little bit about iOS 8 rumors. iOS 7.1 came out. It's been getting some pretty good reviews. Some people have been reporting potentially having shorter battery life, battery issues. I haven't really noticed anything consistent. I've had some days where the battery seemed a little bit off, but I don't know that I can directly attribute it to iOS 7.1. I've had some of those days with iOS 7, and I had those days back in iOS 6, so I'm not going to blame it on that one. But generally, people are pretty happy with the updates to iOS 7, so iOS 7 is kind of matured enough that I think a lot of people really like it. That means we can start talking iOS 8, and we've heard plenty of rumors this past week. One being that the next version of the operating system is going to have the rumored HealthBook app. This is going to be an app. It's going to be Passbook style with the kind of card interface, but instead of tickets and rewards cards and loyalty cards and all those sorts of things, it's going to have little cards to track all of your kind of health stuff. So your steps, your weight, your blood glucose, the oxygenation, water intake, food tracking, all that sort of stuff. Now, some of that functionality, I think, could be handled by the M7 processor that's in the latest iPhone, and it could be passing data to the HealthBook application. But we also know that most people believe Apple's working on some sort of wearable, and that that wearable would have a lot of different sensors and technology to kind of track and feed into an application like HealthBook. So I think it's pretty safe bet that HealthBook's going to be an application at least when we get an iWatch on the market. Is it going to be when we get iOS 8? I think probably, because I think when the iWatch is released, that'll be right around the time that we see iOS 8, sometime in the fall. We're also hearing that Apple's really going to improve the mapping. They're going to have better data, improved accuracy, something that we know they've been working on, something that they've been striving for. So next iteration should be even better. Maps just has been naturally getting better, at least for me. I know in other countries, depending upon where you are, it may still be a little bit off. So hopefully, globally, they'll do a better job with the maps and the mapping data. There are also rumors that they're going to be bringing back the integrated transit directions. That was something Apple offloaded to third-party apps. The integration has always been clunky, never really liked it. I'm not a huge user of transit directions, but it's a really nice feature in Google Maps, and I think Apple wants to bring that back in the fold. We know they acquired at least three companies, Broadmap, Embark, and Hopstop, so certainly they have the wherewithal and the in-house technology to make it happen. It sounds like it might see the light of day in iOS 8. And also, at some point, it seems like they may add augmented reality and indoor mapping features. I would think the indoor mapping features could be helped or work in conjunction with Apple's iBeacon technology in really interesting ways. But sounds like that might not be slated for iOS 8, might end up dropping with iOS 9. So we're already in a way getting some early iOS 9 rumors. Some other things rumored to be in iOS 8. Sounds like Apple might be removing the missed category from the Notification Center. So when you pull down Notification Center, you get today, you get notifications, and you get missed. I guess all notifications and missed. It sounds like they'll just combine the missed under all You just got all your notifications in one place. I think that's nice. It simplifies that interface. Better inter-app communication. So the ability for apps to move data back and forth more seamlessly and easily. Please, oh please, Apple, make this one be true. Something I think a lot of app developers would be very, very excited about. So hopefully we'll hear about hints of that at WWDC. Also, the ability to auto-delete message threads in the messaging app, if you'd like that. That's a feature I'd like. I'm constantly having to go through messages and sort of clean up data. It's also been a source for a lot of you where you get storage, or lost storage, rather, messages, especially if you get a lot of MMS messages with video and pictures. Those can take up a lot of space if you don't purge them and clear them out manually. And there's rumors that Apple might be looking to remove Game Center from iOS 8, something that I think makes a lot of sense. For me, I mostly access Game Center through the application that I'm playing the game in. I very rarely go to that standalone app. I don't know how you are, but I don't think a lot of people do. I think Apple's realizing that, and that the Game Center technology is not going away, so the ability to have leaderboards and all that fun stuff, it's just going to be integrated through the app API and integrated into the application. We really don't need a whole separate app just to run Game Center. There was a weird leak out of China this past week that Apple might be looking to bring text edit and preview apps as standalone apps to iOS. I really doubt it. These mock-ups, they basically showed the old desktop icons, a whole theme that Apple's not going with. Now, again, they could just be prototype icons, but there's so many great third-party apps for doing text editing on iOS. I don't think Apple needs their own application. And Preview would be purely a PDF viewer. Again, something that's already done very well by third-party apps that are free and easy to come by. So I don't think Apple needs to reinvent the wheel on that. I just really don't see them doing that. Another thing that we're hearing about is Apple might be considering giving developers access to a Siri API. Again, oh please, Apple, please, I beg you, let Siri talk to third-party applications. There could be so much functionality, and Siri could be so much more useful if this happens. It's a tricky thing to do, so I get why Apple has held off on this, or is maybe taking longer than most of us would like, because they have to get it right. That's the other thing. This can't be clunky, kludgy, can't have issues, so they're going to have to approach it in a real precise, delicate way. So if that can happen in iOS 8, that would be amazing. We're also hearing that they may finally launch the mobile payment system that's been rumored. It would integrate with Touch ID, something that Tim Cook said they specifically developed Touch ID for, was a payment system that would eventually be coming. No details on exactly how it would work. My preference is that I hope it works a lot like the Easy Pay system in the Apple stores. I've talked about this on the show, where I can go into a store that has Apple's payment system technology enabled, can walk in, scan something, choose to pay with it with my Apple ID, goes directly through Apple's payment processing, tied to my iTunes account, and I authenticate with my Touch ID fingerprint. I think that would be perfect and seamless and easy, and I think a lot of people would really like it. I think it would immediately become very popular. And as I said earlier, forget NFC. You don't need NFC for that. All you have to do is that, and I think people will love it. Finally, when will we see some of this stuff? It's expected we'll get a sneak peek of iOS 8 at WWDC this summer, with a fall release alongside the iPhone 6, new iPads, the iWatch, whatever else Apple wants to bring out into the iOS ecosphere. I think it's all going to be that fall release, just like we saw this year, and that'll be kind of how the timing plays out. And then finally, in the news for today, some news about iTunes Radio. I was actually surprised by this. iTunes Radio is becoming very popular pretty quickly, although it's not by any means the most popular streaming radio service. And I don't necessarily think that that was what Apple was shooting for. I think they were shooting for a great streaming radio service, and eventually they may be able to topple the Pandoras of the world, but I think they're going to be pretty happy when they hear these numbers. Edison Research and Statista found that iTunes Radio is now the third most popular music streaming service, at least in the U.S. You have to remember that iTunes Radio is currently only available in the United States and Australia, so we really can't do an apples to apples comparison across the globe, at least not yet. But in the US for now, 8% of those people surveyed said that they listened to iTunes Radio in the last month. That means that Apple beats out Spotify. That was actually kind of a surprising one to me, which came in at 6%. Of course, again, worldwide, Spotify has a lot more availability, so I think it's a much more popular service than this particular study would indicate. But again, sticking with just the U.S., Pandora was by far the most popular service, with 31% of the people surveyed saying that they listened to that service in the last month. That was followed by iHeartRadio, which came in at 9%. So Pandora, iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio, and then Spotify. Now, rumors are that Apple might be testing an iTunes Radio app, a standalone app, to be released in iOS 8, and that could boost the number of people using the iTunes Radio service. I'm not so sure that that would make a difference. I think most people go into music and they find iTunes Radio naturally. Maybe if you have an icon on the home screen, people are more likely to click it and check it out. But really, that's just a marketing thing more than anything else. So I think that iTunes Radio is a pretty good service right now. It's definitely not the best. I think Apple has some work to do, but I think if they iron out some of the wrinkles, they get the algorithms working a little bit better, address some of the complaints that people have, I think it could be the number two service very, very quickly. And it will take a few years, I think, for it to topple Pandora. Pandora's been around for a really long time. They're really good at what they do. It's sort of like an uphill battle. It's going to be similar to the battle that Apple's fighting with Apple Maps versus Google Maps. But over time, I think, you know, the services will kind of even out, and there's certainly more than enough market share to go around. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we get to our interview with Erfan, I do want to take another quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile Software. You know I'm a huge fan of Smile. I own everything they make, and I think everybody who's a Mac user should own everything they make. If you work with PDFs, though, you need to invest in PDF Pen. If you have to edit, if you have to merge, if you have to search, if you have to fill out forms, anything that you need to do with PDFs, PDF Pen is the tool for you. And it doesn't matter your device, because Smile has the PDF Pen family of products. They have you covered on your Mac. They have you covered on your iPhone. They have you covered on your iPad. And if you need to get documents into PDF format, they have now PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iPad or your iPhone. I use this all the time now. If I need to get a PDF, if I'm out and about and somebody hands me a piece of paper that I need to keep track of, it immediately goes in front of my phone. PDF Pen Scan Plus, snap, do some quick adjustments, turn it into black and white, save it into my Dropbox, and I am good to go. And that's another great thing about the PDF Pen family, is it has integration with iCloud, with Dropbox, so you can get those documents where and when you need them. I am just a huge fan. And that's just one line of product that they have. They also have Text Expander. You can get that for your Mac, for your iPhone, for your iPad, and Disk Label. You can check out all their stuff, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Love it, love it, love it, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I think it was almost exactly, well, just a little over a year ago when I met my next guest, the guy we're going to talk to here in a second, Erfan Elijah from Cult of Mac. He also hosts the Cultcast, and we were at Macworld and literally almost bumped into each other. And I knew about Erfan. I didn't know a lot about him, but I knew he did the show. I know he worked for Cult of Mac. And we met, and instantly I knew I liked the guy. He is just a really fun guy. Great member of the Mac community, and he has kind of an interesting backstory. So when I was thinking about people to have on the show to talk to kind of meet and get to know our Mac community a little bit better, I knew for sure I wanted to get Erfan on. So I was glad I was able to grab this interview with him. It was actually recorded last week and took a little bit longer for me to get out to you, but I think you're really going to like it. I certainly had a really fun time chatting with
you. Well, hey, Irfan, how you doing?
Oh my gosh, so good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for coming on. It's been too long. You've had me over on Cult of Mac, and I've been meaning to get you over on the MacCast, so I'm glad we finally made it happen.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was ever going to happen. I was like, I'm just going to keep having Adam on Cultcast. Maybe eventually he'll reciprocate, but I'm not going to bring it up. But yeah, I'm happy.
Yeah, my schedule, it's crazy. So, but hey, I kind of prepped you a little bit. You're actually going to be my second person. I had Brett Terpstra on recently. We kind of did one of these things. It's something new I'm trying out on the MacCast, and that's like, the audience and people, they'll hear different names or come across different people in the Mac community, be it bloggers or developers or things like that. And I realized, when I started the MacCast, it's really this community show. So I thought it'd be great if we could kind of get to know a little more people in our community, more of the visual names and names people will run across. So obviously with
visual names,
Yeah, that was a horrible.
Those names that really stand out for
the
me.
Names that people will run across. Notable names, I guess I should have said. I'm working
great
off the cuff here.
Yeah. Well, I thought you were just making fun of me because of my totally normal American name, but
you're totally normal.
Yeah, let's talk about me and my story. That
I want to talk about, and I think what it is we all have this point, and where I want to kick it off, and I already kind of prepped you on this one at least, is that at what point do you realize, hey, I'm kind of into this tech nerdy geeky stuff. So I think I shared with you my point. It was sort of like when I realized, the thing my friends and I like to do on the weekends and in our spare time was to code in BASIC on Apple IIe's, right? It's like, okay, I think I like technology, and this is a route I want to go with sort of my life. Did you have one of those epiphany moments, or did it just sort of creep up on you?
I think I did. Well, I think both happened. So I think my dad would definitely tell you that I like technology right from the start, because I was always taking apart his stuff. And as taking something apart is a lot easier than putting it back together. So he ended up with a lot of radios that didn't work. And
so you were taking apart radios?
Oh yeah, all sorts of anything I can get my hands on, gadgets, gizmos. I was always really into Legos, and just taking apart electronics. My dad was also pretty electronics oriented, so we always had like kind of old stuff hanging around the house. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. So grab a screwdriver and just take it apart.
Do you remember the first thing you kind of ripped apart and then realized
you
couldn't get back together?
I don't. I'm having visions of a radio, a gray radio, though I couldn't tell you the brand.
Right.
I just remember my dad's reaction when he saw all the pieces laying all over the floor. And even that I don't remember well. But he wasn't happy with that hobby. I don't think any dad would be. Of course, I was also losing tools all the time too. So always taking stuff apart, never really putting it back together. But I was always really interested in computers, honestly. Growing up, I was huge PC guy, and I would always build computers for myself, for friends. And to your question about having that moment in college, I honestly just thought this is what everyone liked to do, build computers and, surf the web. And I would always like hack my Xboxes to make them do things that they weren't designed to do. And I remember one day I decided to order a magazine subscription, when magazines were still cool.
Right.
For kids that don't know what those are, they're paper and they have like pages in them and stuff.
The mail on a schedule.
Come in the mail, yeah. And I got this magazine in called Maximum PC, which I think they still print today. Have you heard of it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Great
so,
magazine. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, before the internet, if you wanted to learn about something, like you had to get a magazine subscription or go to the library or something. So I got this magazine in for the first time, and I think it was like the December issue. And I kid you not, I opened this thing and it has a centerfold in it. And I was like, oh, what's this? And I open it and there's a skinny, scantily clad lady holding a motherboard. She's in a bikini holding a motherboard. I think that's when I had my moment. I was like, okay, I am not like everybody that I know, you know.
I was gonna make some sort of joke, like, you know, your friends are looking at Playboy centerfolds and you're the guy looking at the, like, the motherboard, but there's still a woman in a bathing suit there.
Your
so,
joke
hey.
Worked too, yeah. And that is an absolute true story. And when I saw that, I was like, okay. I have crossed the boundary, never to return.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I went to one of my meetup groups recently, and we were kind of talking about this. And the guy at the meetup group, he does PC, you know, he builds his own PCs and stuff too. Uh-huh. And he's going, I got to show you guys this because it's hilarious. And it was a video from NVIDIA that came with, like, they had a URL. So he got a new graphics card or something like that. And it had a URL, like, go here to learn how to install your video card, right?
Wow.
And he pulls it up, and it's this really badly dubbed, like, is it Korean? Is NVIDIA Korea? Or, you know, like, Korean video. So it's got this, and it's this Korean, beautiful Korean girl in a bikini.
Of course.
Installing the video card.
I mean, who else would be installing such a device?
But it's dubbed in English, you know, like, really bad, like, overdubbed. And so she starts talking, and the lips are moving. It's just like, oh my gosh, this is nerdery.
Hey, why
this
not,
is nerdery,
right?
At
they
its
know
best.
Their audience. And, you know, it's funny, because I was hooked at that point. I read that magazine religiously for years, and it really helped me learn a lot about the specific components inside computers and, you know, what Intel was doing, what NVIDIA was doing, and all these different companies that you kind of hear about. But again, remember, before the internet, you didn't have easy access to this information.
Right, yeah.
So that was my source. I would wait for that magazine to come, and I loved it. And I would read every single page. And then, of course, you know, I would keep building PCs and upgrading them. And I remember I would, like, overclock them and stuff and put those stupid neon lights in them. That,
so you were hardcore into the PC, build your own PC
hardcore.
Modding kind of.
Yes, very much
community.
So. Yeah, huh. But I was like, man, think how many girlfriends I'm going to get when they see, like, the neon lights in my giant blue tower with fans all over it.
All right. Well, so, okay, now that leads to the question of, at what point did you switch over? Because obviously, I mean, you're doing a Cult of Mac podcast,
yeah, right?
Now, right?
I still am a PC guy. No, I like PCs, but yeah, I did have a moment. It's funny, guys. You asking me, I never really think like there was actually a moment, but I in school majored in programming. I was kind of like Pauly Shore in that movie where he had like 100 different majors, and I never could decide what I wanted to do. And I went from languages to science to this to that. And finally, I took a programming class and really, really kind of fell in love with it.
Do you remember the language?
Yeah, it was ASP.NET.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So VB.NET, I think
you're
it was
a lot
called.
Younger than I am.
Wow, only a few years.
No. I think you're a lot younger than I am. Because I don't know if you, I probably never did. I did C#.NET and VB.NET programming, but that was as a career. I did that.
I mean, that's still around, right? I mean, people still program in VB.NET. And
oh yeah, C#.NET and VB. Yeah, it's huge. Okay, no, it's huge. If you're you know, if you run Microsoft servers, I mean, that's what you're going to be programming in. Absolutely. Yeah. So, but .NET didn't come around. I mean, I had programmed a little VB and ASP before that. I mean, but that was before .NET. And then back then, that wasn't cool. But C# .NET and VB.NET are pretty good languages, I have to admit. Although, frankly, a lot of the, in my mind, a lot of the underlying sort of philosophy of those languages is stolen from Java. So,
oh, Microsoft steal something? No, those are all original concepts.
You know, they're kind of those you know, runtime compiled languages, and you know, they've had a very similar flavor, which made it easy for me to transition into because I had done a little Java, you know, back in the day too. So, anyway, so yeah, so
yeah,
VB.NET.
So I get this programming degree, right? And out of college,
so that's what you actually you finally settled in on, and you got your degree.
Yeah, I got a management information systems degree from Western Washington University, and I mean, it's basically just business and programming.
Right.
And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was computers, and once I learned the coding aspect of it, really enjoyed it. And so I got a job right out of college, and funny enough, it was actually a PHP job. And the shop that I got hired at was using all Macs. I mean, Mac everything. And I had never even really been around that many Macs before. And they had like the original EyeSight cameras, you know, the ones that sit on like on a perch on top of
the FireWire ones. I have one
the
here.
FireWire ones.
Next
yeah.
to me.
And I absolutely, you still have one of those?
Oh, absolutely.
That's great. Do you use it?
No, but it's still it's a really great camera. I did pull it out and use it. Maybe about 5 years ago for like a multi-camera shoot where I used my built-in EyeSight and the FireWire EyeSight, and I could do like two different angles. I think I did a might have been an OS 10 install, and I needed to show my screen, and I didn't really have a way to do that in software. Now you could totally do it in software, but I just like, oh, I'm just going to point this thing at the screen, and I got this extra FireWire.
I'm sure
camera.
The picture quality was glorious. Oh,
it was awful.
A quarter of a megapixel or something.
And that camera was actually ahead of its time. I mean, it was a pretty good camera for compared to the other webcams that were out at the time that were like these postage stamp like crappy cameras.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful. It's such an amazing piece of hardware. And I got one of those. I think I had a G4 MacBook. I guess they were called PowerBooks at the time. And this thing was so beautiful. I just really fell in love with the way it looked.
Yeah.
And that kind of began the transition. And I had to program on this thing, and we were using iChat at the time to communicate with each other. And I was like, this thing is amazing. You know, I think the hardware design really kind of intrigued me. And then the software design really pulled me in. And I remember one day I was trying to change my avatar in iChat, and I grabbed a picture off my desktop, and I just kind of intuitively dragged it and dropped it onto the little avatar area that kind of lived in your iChat window,
right,
where all your like contacts were. And it changed it. And I truly, even then, I was shocked because I was like, they figured out what I was going to try and do, and they made it work. Because you could never, even to this day on Windows machines, you could still couldn't pull off a feat like that. You know what I mean?
Well, I think you probably could, but I mean, it took them a hell of a long time. But I know what you're getting at, and I talk about this a lot on my show. It's this sort of concept of, for some reason on Windows, the general experience on a day-to-day basis is fighting with the technology to kind of get it to do what you want.
Yeah.
As opposed to just thinking what you want to do and doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I say that coming from, you know, having programmed Windows machines for 5 or 6 years. I went into an office every day and worked on a Windows machine. So, you know, I don't say that flippantly, and it's not to just sort of be the, you know, hey, I'm a Mac fanboy bashing kind of thing. It's just, it's the reality of the experience. I just found that, you know, a lot of times at my job, I'd be sitting there just wanting to program, but I was having to fiddle with something. I call it like fiddly. It's like fiddly computing. And it's great for the people who really like to tinker, like that place you're coming from where it's like, I want to be able to get in and rip the thing apart and do whatever I want with it. So I totally get it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but that's an experience, I think, for 10% of the world that they really like to have, you know, and they enjoy that. And I think those are the people that are really the diehard Windows, or even, I mean, Unix geeks are the same way, right? Mm-hmm. If you're running some distro of Linux, you're totally in that world. You're like, I want to just go in and mess with everything, and I don't care if this breaks because I can figure out how to fix it. And that's my world, and I love it. And that's awesome. That's totally awesome. But for a guy like me, you know, most of the time I want to sit down on my computer and I want to create something, and I don't want the tool that I'm using
to get in your way.
Yeah, I don't want to fight with that tool. I just want to pick up the tool and use it and make something.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Everything you just said is spot on for me. And I kind of grew out of the phase where I wanted to tinker. I still like to tinker here and there, but I have work to do. I have things I need to get done, and I really want the computer to get out of my way and let me do those things. And I don't have neon lights installed in my tower anymore. I don't even have a tower anymore. Actually, I take that back. I have a media PC that I did build, and it isn't a tower, but there are no neon lights.
Well, we might have to talk about that in a little bit. I'm curious.
It's pretty
about
old
that.
Though. It's like got like a dual core processor still from like the early 2000s. But so yeah, that transition over just using the computer really won me over. And one day I remember sitting listening to iTunes, and I think this is going to sound so corny. I was in the like, you know, the community, student community area, listening to iTunes on this really beautiful computer, and I had a, I had a, I had a moment with this machine, and it was so poignant in my life. I actually wrote a blog post. I had a personal blog at the time, which is no longer.
I think we all did.
I think it was mandatory at that time to have one. And I wrote this post about how much I loved this machine. I had such a feeling of emotion for it that I felt compelled to write this piece.
So you obviously remember which one it was. Sorry to cut you off, but
oh no, that's fine. Yeah, and from then on, I was a convertee at that point. I saw the light, and it's never really been the same since. I've been hardcore Mac ever since.
You remember?
And the
which
only
Mac
PC I have is my media PC. What's that?
Do you remember which Mac that was? Was that the MacBook Pro you're talking, or the Mac?
Yeah, I think it was a G4 PowerBook.
G4 PowerBook. It was one of the aluminum ones. It almost sounds like I had the white G4 iBook, and that was probably one of my favorite Macs that I've ever owned. And I fried it recently because I was trying to repair it, but it didn't go so
You're trying to tinker. Yeah, you can't do that with a Mac.
Well, it has this really bad habit of the solder points on the graphics chip, you know, fail after a period of time, and that happened to it. And I saw this thing online. It's like, oh yeah, you can just, you know, reflow the solder, and here's how you do it. And it was funny because I pulled it apart and I did it, and it worked for about a second, and then it broke again. And then I tried to do a little bit more, and yeah,
and that was it, huh?
Yeah, I did it, and I think what happened is, if you get in there, the pins are so close to. I mean, it's so tiny, you know, yeah. It's like microscopic. And I was in there with a magnifying glass and everything, but I think I bridged two of the with the solder. I think I bridged two of the little pins, and so when I plugged it in, it started smoking. And I was like, oh, that's
always
it.
A bad sign. Yeah.
You don't want that going. You don't want smoke coming out of your
computer.
Unless
you have a PC,
computer.
That's just normal.
Oh,
just,
that's normal?
That little bit of smoke coming out of the vent. Yeah, it goes away eventually. So you had that thing a long time, though.
The white
iBook.
iBook. Yeah, I love that. I love that. It's actually still here under the desk. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I got to give it a proper burial or something like that.
You should actually bury it and take pictures and all that stuff. Maybe write a nice eulogy.
You have a little eulogy. Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah. Put on your best suits and have your family come out. I'm sure they wouldn't mind at all.
Yeah. Okay. So I already know two things I want to move into. I want to move into how you ended up at Cultimac, but I want to hold off on that because there's a little backstory that you have that I found out after we met, which I think was at Macworld just a couple years ago. We ran into each other on the show floor. I think it was in front of the Hyper Mac
booth.
Or yeah. No, they're not called. What are they? They keep changing their name. They were Hyper Mac. Now it's
they sell batteries though, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I always blank on that. They sell Hyper Drive is the product, but now they're called maybe just Hyper. Might just be Hyper. I don't know.
I think it might just be Hyper. Yeah.
Anyway, if everybody knows who we're talking about, we ran into you there, and I had kind of seen you around and seen your name around different places, probably through Cultimac, and so you know, I did the thing that we all do in this day and age, right? We went and Googled you.
Yeah.
And there's just
was it right there as we were talking?
No. I didn't do it on my phone as we were talking.
I was like, no wonder, because you weren't really making eye contact with me.
Yeah, no. And so you had a little claim to fame as a celebrity Twitter imposter.
Yeah. So I wouldn't know. I don't know if I got any fame from it, but it was definitely fun. So I impersonated Neil Patrick Harris on Twitter.
Oh, NPH.
For like a good, I would say, 18 months. And it was a ton of fun. I started it as a joke. And it grew to a point where I got one of those Twitter messages, a direct message from Jimmy Fallon thanking me for coming on the show. I mean, not even kidding you. I mean, I was like, this is getting out of control, right? And you must have saw my Ignite talk. Is that what you
That's
used?
Exactly what I watched. Yeah, there's a great YouTube video.
I pitched them this talk because I was like, I need to tell this story because it was such an incredible story that all this crazy stuff had happened. And I titled it My Secret Life as a Celebrity Twitter Imposter.
Right.
And so I gave up and I gave this talk where you advance your slides every, I think, 10 or 15 seconds without you touching anything.
Format. Yeah, you got it.
Exactly. So basically what happened is This is going to sound so dumb, and I apologize to everyone who's listening. So I'm a really huge fan of the Harold and Kumar movies.
Have you seen any of them? I have. They're on my list of things to see, though, because I think I totally would like them. I'd be totally into them.
Watch it with your kids.
No.
But the first one is knee-slapping funny.
Is that the White Castle one? Was that the first in this? Okay.
Yeah, and I think the second one is they escape from Guantanamo Bay or something. And
it can't be any worse than, like, you know, the Hangover series or anything like that, right?
No, I would say they're probably on par. Yeah, they're probably on par, especially since there's full frontal male nudity.
I haven't even seen any of those either. Okay, so,
okay, well, you know, don't watch those with your kids either. And so I really liked this movie. And, you know, Neil Patrick Harris was a star forever ago. He was, what was the name of that show?
Doogie Howser.
Doogie Howser, MD.
See, you're going back to my time again. See?
Okay, well, I used to watch that show too. I might have been a little younger than you when I watched it, but really loved that show. And if you remember, after that whole series, he kind of disappeared for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a resurgence in this role as this just overly sexualized, really crass character. He's playing himself, hyper-sexualized version of himself, in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. And I loved that role. I thought it was so funny. And Twitter at the time was probably 2 years old. And I did a search. You know, I was like, oh, it'll be really funny. I'll start like a Neil Patrick Harris, you know, parody account, and tweet as he would be tweeting, you know, as the character from that movie.
Was that before? Wait, I got to pause you there. So do you think that was before that became like a thing? Like, were you the pioneer of the imposter Twitter
account? I can't take credit for that, but I do know that he wasn't doing it when I first signed up for my account. I mean
that
a lot of
like it was before fake Steve Jobs and all that, right?
Oh yeah, I think it was. And I think it was before Ashton Kutcher was on Twitter. It was before a lot of those celebrities really embraced Twitter as like an actual medium that was gonna be popular.
Right.
You know? And so I started this account, and I remember starting to get emails because Twitter would send you emails when you got followers. And first they trickled in, and then they started coming in so fast, I had to churn the alerts off because I was just getting hundreds of followers a day. And I was having a ton of fun. I think a lot of people kind of knew that I wasn't actually him. My name was Real NPH. And I would not ever show pictures of him. I didn't talk about his life. I just tweeted like I was this character, and it grew and it grew and it grew and it grew until finally one day I got shut off by Twitter. And I kind of took offense to that, because I guess what had happened is his publicity people had seen that there was somebody on Twitter named The Real MPH.
Right. That's his real account
to Twitter,
right?
And Twitter shut – well, no, not quite. There's a little spin here at the end.
Okay.
And so they shut me off, and I emailed them under the auspices that I was very upset. My name was actually Neil Patrick Harris. I'm just a normal American citizen. How dare they shut me off just because some Twitter or some person who's not even using Twitter. Yeah, some twit who's not even using the platform is complaining. And so I had this email exchange with them back and forth. And all of a sudden, one day out of the blue, boom, I'm back up and running. And I got an email from them that said, you know, please, you know, don't impersonate Patrick Harris, and put a disclaimer on your page that says you're not him. So I was like, okay, fine, no problem. So he had this web series called Dr. Horrible Sing-Along Blog, and it was getting really, really popular. And they ended up winning a bunch of awards. And at the same time, he went on Jimmy Fallon's show, and they were talking about it. And he did all these magic tricks for Jimmy Fallon, because, you know, he's really into magic. And I remember getting tweets from Nathan Fillion and some of his other co-actors when we won this award, and everyone was really excited. And that's when the account really blew up, because they were all, you know, tweeting at me, congratulating me for winning this award. And then they started kind of getting, you know, clued into the fact that maybe it wasn't actually Neil Patrick Harris. And then Jimmy Fallon sent me that DM. He was like, it was great having you on the show. You should come back and do more magic tricks. And then I knew, I was like, it's only a matter of time before Twitter shuts me off again, right? Because everyone thinks I'm him, even though I'm not him.
Right.
I had so many followers at that point that I had the appearance of authenticity, right? I wasn't doing anything wrong. I really don't think. I was just having fun. And then sure enough, within, I would say, 2 or 3, maybe 4 weeks, I got shut down again. And this time Twitter wouldn't even reply to my emails. They wouldn't even comment on it, nothing. But I have a sense of gratification because shortly thereafter, remember, I was the real MPH.
Right.
He signed up for his own account and his Twitter handle, actually MPH.
Oh, actually MPH.
Actually MPH, which is what it is to this day. So
that's awesome.
In a way, I helped him select his Twitter handle.
His Twitter handle. That's, I love that story. That's just awesome. Thanks for
thank you,
everybody in.
I never get to tell it, but it was a lot of fun. And I'm getting a DM from Jimmy Fallon, you know, who's on the Tonight Show now, and we're close personal friends. I kind of feel like now since he DM'd me.
So okay, so you've gone to school, you've got the programming degree, you're impersonating Neil Patrick Harris.
Yes,
and then you know, you've taken this job where you converted over to Mac. How do you wind up and land at Cult of Mac then?
So gosh, another random occurrence. I in 2008 went on a backpacking trip around Europe for 9 weeks. A wonderful experience. And in about week three, when you're on a vacation that's that long, actually it's more like an adventure rather than a vacation. Your mind starts to clear and you start to think really clearly. And I just had a lot of downtime. And I was like, you know what? I've always had this idea that I wanted to start a graphic t-shirt company.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the economy was taking a downturn at that time. So I was thinking it would be a good time to just at least try it out, because maybe by the time I have it up and running, the economy will be recovering and I'll be in a good position at that point, right? So I started this business called Might Tees. And we made these as our first, one of our first line of t-shirts. We made these really, Apple centric t-shirts that were inspired by, Steve Jobs and, you know, different Apple PCs and stuff for computers. Mm-hmm. And, Cult of Mac wrote about it.
I think I saw those on Cult of Mac.
You may have. And, our sales just skyrocketed on all those shirts, and we sold out of a bunch of them. And it was Nicole Martinelli, who still writes for Cult of Mac to this day, who wrote the story. And I reached out to her via Facebook, and I just said, hey, thank you. You know, like, that really helped us out a lot. We're obviously a very small company. And just kind of started a conversation with her, and she was really friendly. And I can't believe that she actually talked to me. I mean, she had no idea who I was. And we had this ongoing dialogue. So I said, hey, you know, I'm really into Apple computers, as you can see. You know, I would really be interested in writing for you guys if you have anything open. And I still don't know why she did this, but she's like, yeah, let me check. And she introduced me to Leander Caney. I mean, who does that, right? I mean, like, this no-name guy who sells t-shirts, and you introduce him to your editor. And so I was emailing back and forth with Leander, and everyone knows Leander. He's like super nice, you know, the friendliest guy. But when he doesn't know you, you know, he can come off as a bit abrasive, and especially when it's, you know, business related. And
right.
He said, you know, send me some writing samples.
Right. I was going to say, had you done any writing at that point? Like, I'm going to be a writer.
On my personal blog. On my personal blog. And then if you'll recall that piece I wrote on that Mac I fell in love with,
right.
I was like, boom, you know, I already got
Justin to
send this guy, right? So I sent him this piece thinking this is some of my best work. I mean, you know, I think I have a pretty good chance that he's going to like it. And a couple days later, he comes back to me and he said, no, this really isn't what I'm looking for at all. and this is really not the type of writing we do. And it would need to be much shorter in length and much more technical and blah, 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 blah. And I was feeling really deflated that I had sent him my best work and kind of got rejected. So I said, hey, look, why don't we do this? I'm really into photography. I know you guys do photography pieces on your website now and again. Why don't you let me write these pieces for you? And I'll send them to you. And if you like them, you can run them. And if not, no problem. You know, I'll go about my business and leave you alone. So he said yes. And I did this post on, I forget what it was, like, it was like the top 10 camera tips for DSLR photography or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being one of the most popular posts that week.
Blew up.
And at that point, it was just like, you know, Leander's like, this guy's going to work for free. And, you know, he's writing popular posts like shoe in, right? He was like, yeah, put out more stuff like that.
You're going to work for free.
Yeah, exactly. And I did.
Oh, so I was going to say, I thought we were leading down the path to help our audience, you know, all the people who want to break into blogging for a Mac site, you know, we were going to give them the key, and I guess the key is be willing to work for free.
Yeah, well, you know what, that's funny, but it's true. Do whatever you can and do it for free. I mean, get as much experience as you can, because I'll tell you what happened is eventually CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, was coming up.
Yep.
And he was not really gonna go, and I was asking them what they were thinking about, and then he was like, yeah, we're gonna go with a small team. And I was kind of like, you know what, I'm going to go too. I just want to go again and hang out, really secretly hoping that I would get to like hang out with them. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, well, if you're going to come, why don't you crash at our place? Cause we're going to have a hotel there.
Right.
And that's what I did. I flew myself down there, paid my way, didn't get paid. And
so work for free and stalking. I'm just making a list here.
Yeah. And I had been surveilling his home for weeks, you know, so I knew like his favorite foods. You know, like perfect size underwear. I got brought that as a gift. But, you know, truly, I mean, it worked. And, you know, Leander's a friend now. And, you know, it led into, you know, all these other things that I'm doing with Cultimac. So, I mean, people ask that question. And it's funny because you say, oh, well, you know, do it for free. But honestly, if you don't have experience and you really want to do it, and that's what you need to do, you need to do whatever you can.
Well, I think that's the point, right? That is like, the first thing is deciding, hey, this is what I really want to do and what I'm passionate about. And, you know, when you're passionate about doing something, you don't really think about the paycheck when you're beginning it. I mean, I think about like when I started the MacCast, like there was no even thought that there was ever going to be any money in it. It was just sort of like, I kind of just want to do this.
Yeah. I mean, and when you started, especially, podcasts weren't even really a popular thing.
There wasn't even a directory when I started. Yeah. Like there was like no, you had to like, I think there were some like scripts. There might've been an Apple script you could get that Adam Curry wrote, you know, you could download and it would find some podcasts for you or something. I don't know. It was like, how anybody found podcasts, you know, it was beyond me. And then
you were truly a pioneer of that. I mean, you were doing it right out of the gates, because I feel like now even podcasting is kind of a new platform that people are discovering. Yeah. I mean, when you were doing it, the idea of even getting paid for something like that must not even have been.
There wasn't even, no one was even talking about it. No. There were no advertisers. There was no, like, nobody knew. It was just something a bunch of nerdy people did. But I mean, blogging started out that way too, right? I mean, that's what you're talking about. Everybody kind of had these personal blogs, and then it sort of evolved into a thing. But even beyond that, I think anything I've done in my professional life in terms of a career has been advanced by really just kind of being passionate about the thing that I want to do. Mm-hmm. And you know, somehow, and it sounds cliche, but I mean, sort of the money just sort of has always come along, mm-hmm. you know, with the passion. I think that's because when you have a passion for something like that, people recognize the quality of the work. And it sounds like what happened in your case, right? It's just like, I am passionate about photography. I know I can really write about this. I really want to write for you guys. I'm going to write some stuff. And it just kind of works out.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And in fact, one of my favorites, Steve Jobs appearances, was that Stanford commencement address he gave in 2005. Mm-hmm. And he even talks about that very thing. He's like, you're going to spend a majority of your life working. And the only way to do great work is to do something that you love. And I really think that's true. And I really try to think about that in my own personal work, because truly, if you're not doing something that you love, there's going to be someone who does it better than you. And the only way to really make, I think, good money, decent money doing, you know, whatever it is that you're doing is to be as good at it as you possibly can be.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, why are people going to pay to consume it, right? I mean,
my story, like where it doesn't work out, is totally that. I mean, right out of college, so my degree is in printing, actually magazine and book design, but like ink on paper printing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I was looking at sort of the job, so I could go into pre-press and things like that, and pre-press guys didn't really make all that much money. So I'm like looking at like this degree that I have, and I'm like, I'm not going to probably, not going to get rich off that, right? So I got, but you know who makes a lot of money? Those sales guys. They get commissions and they sell those big jobs. And so immediately out of college, I took this sales job. I'm like, I can sell printing. I know all about this stuff, right? I know that I know how to like, I know how to run a press for Pete's sake, right? I can, how hard could this be to sell stuff? Well, it turns out if you're not a salesman, it's actually pretty darn hard. And if you don't care about it, if you're only in it for the money, you tend to not be all that great at it. So I was like, the worst salesman ever, and I did okay. I mean, I made a little money, but I wasn't, I was obvious real quick. I wasn't going to get rich off of it. And it was because I didn't really care about it. Right. It was just like, I'm in it for the money. Well, if you go in it, I think for the money, you know, if like that's your motivation, like, I'm going to get rich by doing this thing, that's very rarely going to work out.
Yeah. And it's hard to stick to it too, because you're going to be working a long time, especially in podcasting, especially in blogging. You're going to be working for, you know, for peanuts basically.
Yep.
And you're lucky if you get the salted kind, you know, normally it's going to be like the plain peanuts that no one likes. Yep. Like, you really got to like what you're doing in order to continue to hone your craft. And I say craft loosely, but you know, to get better at whatever it is that you're doing, so that eventually somebody somewhere will pay you to do that. And or you'll get enough listeners, you know, that people that you'll be able to get sponsors.
Right.
So you got to do what you love. If you haven't listened to that Steve Jobs commencement address, it's on YouTube. I listen to it probably once a month just as motivation. You should go check it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you look at the Apple story in general, right? I mean, Woz and Steve had no clue. I mean, when they were starting Apple, it was very much, especially on Woz's side, not about the money. And actually, Woz had to get out because it became about the money. You know?
Right.
So if, if you read his book, which is excellent, and I really recommend to anybody. I mean, everybody's read the you know, the Steve Jobs bio, but I think the Woz one is almost more worth reading.
What's that one called again?
iWoz.
iWoz. Okay. And did he actually write that? Or was that a ghostwriter?
No. He worked with a writer, but I mean, if you read it. And if you've ever had a chance to meet Woz or even hear Woz speak, it's totally his voice. I mean, like, I'm reading.
Are there any periods in the book?
No.
Or is it just one sentence from start to end?
No, but it's also that really down to earth way that he speaks. Like, he's a really technical and extremely, extremely smart guy.
Yeah, he is.
But when you hear him talk, it's just such, how he speaks is so plain. You know, it's just so, like, you would expect him to be really this technical engineer. And there's a little bit of that in there. I think he can't avoid the nerdiness at any point. But, I mean, just in terms of, again, if you've ever heard him speak publicly, I heard his voice. As I'm reading the whole book, I'm hearing Woz talking in my head, right? Because I know his voice. Yeah. And it's like, oh, this is totally him. You know, he's just telling these stories about, you know, how they just wanted to, you know, do this stuff because it was cool. It was for their friends. They were going to build these cool things because, you know, people would want them. And they had no idea, you know, how big it was going to become. And it was never even a thought, even as things grew. It was just sort of like, especially for Woz, it's just, I just want to make this really cool stuff.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, when you said especially for Woz, I mean, don't you think that Steve Jobs always kind of knew? I feel like he always kind of knew. He didn't know what they were going to do, but he knew that's where he wanted to go. And he was also incredibly smart, man, and so articulate. Every time I hear him speak, Jobs, that is, he's so articulate, and he's able to tell stories and describe things so well. I really think that he honed a lot of his skill set too, just out of this passion for wanting to build great products. And I mean, him finding Woz was like, you know, Bono finding the rest of U2.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they just kind of melted so well together.
Yeah. I think, you know, for Steve Jobs' part of it, I think he still had that same passion, but he also realized that in order to do the kinds of things that they wanted to do, you know, somebody had to do the business thing. Like, you're going to need the money. You're going to need that sort of stuff. But what I really do believe is with both of them, it was never the core motivation, right? It was more of a means to an end as opposed to some other companies where it's just like, we got to make the money.
Yeah, I'm totally with you there. I think Steve Jobs, particularly, he just wanted to build a great product. I mean, he really wanted to build a product that people would use and really love. And I think that was really his fulfillment. Right. Out of building this
but you
company.
Can't do that for free, right?
Definitely can't do that for free.
You need a big R&D budget and you need a lot of smart people around you, and that was another one of his core talents. As much as people hate the fact that, you know, he wouldn't, what do you call them, the B players or the bozos, right, weren't yeah. allowed. I mean, and that's harsh and it sounds, you know, awful, and a lot of people got trampled, but I mm-hmm. you know, I think mm-hmm. when you're going for perfection, you really can't have anybody that's beyond, you know, sharing that sort of same passion and drive for like perfection.
You know,
whether you achieve it or not is a whole other thing, but you need people at least that are like, all they want to do is achieve that.
Yeah. I mean, if you achieve it, everyone's like, man, that guy's great, you know, and I really respect him. Or if you don't, everyone's like, yeah, that guy was just as big of an idiot as I thought he was. He was such a jerk. But yeah, looking back through history, I mean, Steve Jobs built exactly what he wanted. And, you know, it's true. He came off as a jerk, and he probably didn't need to be as big of a jerk as he was. But no. In the same regard, you know, he had the cojones to do what needed to be done in order to get to the place where he thought Apple needed to go. And I mean, look at the company he built, you know, and not just the products, but that company as a product
right.
is unlike any other company that's out there. I mean, they're able to do things that no other company can do.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I don't know if I would want to work for him.
For Steve Jobs? No. I definitely would want to work for Tim Cook, I think.
I think so too. Although I mean, the word on the street is that new book that's coming out kind of paints Tim Cook as maybe not the nicest guy.
Well, I don't think any CEO can be the nicest guy. You know,
I'm with you. I think you kind of have to have an iron spine. We actually talked about this on Cultcast. You can't get up that high and be a pushover. I mean,
no.
You have to develop an iron spine to run a company like that, right? Especially to deal with all the criticism that you're always getting from everyone who thinks they know more than you.
Yeah, you're always going to have to make a hard decision, and you know, people are going to get hurt when you're that high up. You can't be always looking out for, you know, the people per se in any given situation. So I guess it's how you handle it and the tact that you take when you're handling it. So mm-hmm. I haven't read too much about that story. I've seen it floating around, so maybe you know a little bit more. But I mean, is it saying that he sort of has that harsh edge that Steve has and he just sort of hides it? Or I always got him as more of a kinder, gentler, like he'd be have more tact in making those tough decisions.
You know, so I haven't read the book, so I can't answer that. But yeah, that was my impression of him as well, is that he was kind of one of Steve Jobs. I want to use the word henchman, but
right.
that's totally the wrong word because I don't think that's what he was. But he was the guy that got things done in
right.
in a lot of situations. And I think your intuition is probably right. Like he probably maybe was effective and assertive, but still in a much more rounded way, you know?
He's not the kind of guy that's going to walk into a job interview and ask you if you're a virgin.
No, I highly doubt that. The only virgin he deals with are the virgin daiquiris he probably drinks on the weekend because they're filled with delicious fruits. And he's probably not going to be the guy that puts a finger in your face and tells you that you're an idiot for not getting the feature built that he wanted either. So
right.
I probably would much rather work for Tim Cook. I kind of have a man crush on Tim Cook. I don't know if you know that.
No,
talk about
it
on my show. I love the guy. I think he's great. And he's such an entertaining character because, I mean, he is so subdued. But when you watch him speak, you can tell there's so much going on underneath.
Oh, he's an amazing speaker.
That facade. Yeah, I think he's very good. And he had such a huge role to fill. I mean, to come into Steve Jobs' role and run it your own way and do your own thing and kind of, you know, craft your own persona, I think is incredibly admirable. I don't think a lot of people could do it.
Yeah, I had to do a whole podcast on that. I think I called it, what did I call it? Let Tim Cook be Tim Cook or something like that. Back when everybody was like in the transition after Steve passed away, everybody was being hypercritical of Tim. And I came out on that show and I said, I think really what's going to happen is, you know, Tim Cook is going to run Apple the way Tim Cook's going to run it. And it's going to be different. But we can't jump out and assume that it's going to be bad, you know? And it's like so many people were like, oh, it's over, it's done. You know, Apple can't survive with Tim Cook at the helm because he's this totally different guy. And it's been great to watch him over the last couple of years, really see him run Apple the way he wanted to run it. And, you know, we're seeing more stuff in terms of the humanitarian efforts and the environmental efforts. And I fully expected to see that sort of stuff become more visible under Tim Cook. I don't know that it wasn't happening before, but definitely it's something that, you know, is his passions. And so that's cool. It's to kind of see him take his passions and bring that into the Apple culture. And that's new and different. But, you know, I don't think it's at all bad. I think it's actually great.
Yeah. I mean, if they can create amazing products and do all that stuff that Tim Cook focuses on as well, the humanitarian, environmental stuff, then, yeah, I mean, who's got a problem with that, right?
Right, and I mean, better stuff for their employees. I mean, they're doing more with the, you know, that sort of stuff. And you know, it's a very different way of running the company. But, you know, I think that all the core passions are still there. And that was the other thing he's been very adamant about. You know, we're going to maintain and stick to our core philosophies. But, you know, outside of that, he gets to run the company where the way he wants to run the company.
The only thing that I would want from Tim Cook to do that he doesn't do now is, could he just put on like a mock turtleneck once in a while? I mean, just once in a while, maybe just at the keynotes.
No, that'd
just
be
slip
awful.
One on, tuck it into the jeans.
Totally not his style.
Maybe not wear the New Balance. Maybe go with a different brand of shoe. I don't know, like Nikes or something. You know, do it in his own way. Maybe, you know, have like a nice brooch or something on the shirt, but, you know, do it up nice. So, yeah, I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon.
Two other things that I want to jump into that are more Apple related, sort of what's going on with the latest news and stuff like that. You mentioned that you have a media PC. Do you have an Apple TV as well?
I do not.
Huh.
Yeah, okay. Sacrilege, I know, right?
No, I don't know if it's sacrilege. I'm just curious because people on my who've been listening to my show know that recently I've been kind of, I do have Apple TVs and I love my Apple TVs and I've been actually buying more and more stuff on iTunes movie-wise. I don't have a Blu-ray player, so I never went that route. So for HD content, I'm kind of relying on Apple. Although more recently, I've been kind of getting into the whole Plex thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, your media server, are you fully Windows media PC or have you messed with Plex or how do you, what are you doing for media these days?
Plex is like an application that you run that manages all your content, right?
It's a media server. Yeah. It's web-based. Yeah. It's actually Python, I think, is what it runs on. So it's basically a little server and you point it at folders and it goes out. And the big thing with Plex, a couple big things is one, it goes out and gets all the metadata sort of automatically. So if you haven't really tagged your stuff well or done anything with it, it can kind of figure out what you have and it pulls in, you know, all the directors and the artwork and all that stuff for you. It's pretty darn awesome. And I was using it to, cause I wanted to finally digitize my, I had a pretty, like a 200 disc DVD movie library.
Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
I gotta get this stuff in some format. So I've loaded it into iTunes and I've loaded it into Plex and I'm kind of playing around with both. And you know, the nice thing about Plex is it doesn't have the DRM and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But yeah. I still am in this kind of bipolar world because I don't have a Blu-ray player, so I don't buy Blu-ray discs. So the only way I can get HD really is to buy it from iTunes. And then I'm dealing with it, the whole DRM garbage. So
yeah, exactly. I've always ripped movies that I've had around and you know, watched them off the hard drives on this media PC. And one of the things I don't like about Plex, in fact, one of the things I don't like about a lot of those media management services,
Plex is based on XBMC, as a matter of fact. I think it's sort of
I've tried Xbox Media Server, right? Yeah, I tried that one too, which doesn't run on the Xbox. It used to. When I had an Xbox, I actually had that installed. Or the first Xbox. The thing I didn't like about those kind of servers is that they always have their own built-in codecs, right? So when you go to play a movie, it has its own batch of codecs that come pre-installed. And I found, especially with HD content, especially when you're dealing with like MKV files and stuff, that no matter how powerful your computer is, if you don't have the right codec, you're going to deal with audio that's not synced correctly, and especially like video sputtering and stuttering. And I had a lot of troubles with that. And finally, I figured out a solution where I use, I forget the name of the codec, and then this really old media player. I think it's called Media Player Classic, in fact, that you can install. And with this codec and that player, I had zero problems. And I'm running a PC with no dedicated graphics card. So it has the built-in Intel graphics chip from like probably 2008, 2009. And this thing can do 1080p no problem all day long.
Wow.
And so for me, even though it was kind of a hassle to keep all my media in various folders on these hard drives I have in the PC, the experience was much, much better. So that's the way I went. And then I just created a saved search on my desktop. So when I click it, it brings up all the movies and all the different hard drives and all the locations on my computer. So I don't get the pretty album art, but you know, I get the better viewing experience.
Do you do everything in MKV then?
Not everything, but yeah, some stuff is in MKV and some stuff is in, you know, like MP4. I forget the other formats I have, but a lot of it, MKV is so easy to use and it's a popular format these days.
Yeah, that's another thing they're doing with Plex that a lot of people like, although you need to have a pretty beefy computer that you're running the server on, is Plex will do on-the-fly transcoding of everything. So if you're Plexing out to, say, an iOS device, you know, it'll transcode it down. So if you have MKVs stored in there, it'll actually convert it down for you. But again, you need to have, in order for that to work properly, you kind of have to have a big, you know, a pretty good server that's going to be able to process that pretty quickly.
Yeah, and probably like a modern one.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. So there's no way it would work on the system that you're describing, because, you know, and I've gotten around that because I just kind of I found some tools to actually just pre-transcode everything down to a lower bit rate. Actually, the guy that Don Melton did some great shows for iMore for the Vector podcast on transcoding, and he was kind of the guy that was in charge of Apple's internet. I'm going to get it's the other half of, not the Eddie Q half of the business, the internet business, but sort of the other half that was like all about iTunes movies and transcoding and stuff like that. So he kind of,
so he knows the stuff.
Yeah. And so he worked out some scripts and some settings for the command line interface for Handbrake to kind of distill it down to basically match what you would get if you were buying, you know, movies from Apple. And it's this lower bitrate stuff that'll pretty much, you know, just go straight across on Plex. So Plex, I just turn off the transcoding on Plex and this stuff will go across the network, across 802.11 and no problem, you know, without.
Are you watching stuff on your iOS device that often that you want to transcode it on the fly? And
I don't. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Like these scripts, it's great because it transcodes everything. It takes your raw rips and transcodes them into this format that doesn't need to be retranscoded, you know, for your different platforms. So I can take the same file and play it on my iPhone or my iPad or my Apple TV. So 1080p all the way down to, you know, whatever I want to do. And I think most of it's just 720p. I don't even think I'm doing 1080p stuff.
Yeah, I mostly do 720p too, because 1080p just takes up so much more space. And I've heard that, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that if you don't have a 50-inch TV or larger television, make that much of a difference.
That's what I've heard too. And I don't have anything bigger than that. So I actually got my first 1080p TV like a couple weeks ago. So.
Oh, wow. Your 720p is going to look great on that.
It actually does. I mean, I have these. It's funny because I have these. I used those scripts and I was like, these DVD rips that I did are going to be awful. But they look awesome.
Yeah. When you do your own DVD rips, I mean, yeah, they almost look HD quality.
Because DVD is 480p. I mean, you don't even have 720 coming off a DVD. So.
Yeah. But we're so used to seeing, you know, compressed, crappy signal, digital signal especially, that I think that when you see something that, you know, it has a lot of information in it, it just looks so much better.
Yeah.
Even DVD stuff, even when you've ripped it, can look so nice. You would think that it's, you know, 720p, but you know, sometimes I gotta admit, if I don't want to transcode a movie myself, but I have it, I'll just download it from online. And I hope the FBI aren't listening to this.
No, you don't do that. Right?
No, I'm kidding. This is hypothetical. I was kidding. Okay. But I've heard that people do this because that way, you know, you don't have to go through all the work of doing all the transcoding
work.
Yeah, it's just you just get the final product again.
But we wouldn't do that. We do the work if we have
in Austria.
You know, no, we don't even do that. We buy everything from iTunes.
From iTunes, yeah, or stream, of course. That's the other. Netflix is a good option too.
All right, let's before the door breaks down here. So last thing, I guess we should be a little bit timely and talk about. So iOS 7.1 came out.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to mess around? It's getting like a lot of good buzz. A lot of people are like super excited about the UI enhancements and some of the little tweaks and things like that.
Yeah, I'm right in that boat. I think it's great. I've had it installed for several days now. I'm one of those guys that doesn't do the beta stuff. I like to experience products when they're, you know, fully baked.
Mm-hmm.
And plus that way, when I give my impression, it's the same impression that a lot of our audience is going to have as well, because they're just using it for the first time. Lots of great UI tweaks. I think my immediate reaction was, this is what iOS 7.0 should have been like.
I think a lot of people are saying that. And it's funny because you wouldn't think to hear that in sort of in like a point release. Like there's a lot of good little enhancements in here that I think just make the experience better. It almost feels like, yeah, you're right. Like 7 wasn't kind of fully baked and maybe shouldn't have been released.
Yeah.
And this is like 7 fully baked.
It is. Yeah. They definitely needed the time, and the amount of polish they put on it is really, really great. And I think one of my favorite features, besides the fact that some of the icons in the phone app are more clearly labeled and look better, mm-hmm. is just the opening and closing of apps and folders. They've increased the speed of those animations.
Yeah, that was a huge problem.
Did you think it was a problem? I did too. I was always...
I guess problem might be... It was a thing that was a problem that you couldn't put your finger on, because if you didn't know about it, like I knew about it and you knew about it, but like I think the average person just went... Something about this experience doesn't feel right, right? That was the impression that you got. And now people are going, oh, it's so snappy and stuff like that. Well, it's like, no, I think they smoothed it out and put it the way it should have been.
Well, I would argue that you could put your finger on it, but if you did it too soon, it just wouldn't do anything. So,
you know what's odd? The other one that I ended up really liking that I kind of, when I first saw this being reported about, I'm like, well, that's silly.
I know what you're about to say.
What?
What is it? No. Is it control center?
No. Oh, okay. It's a really simple one. It's the darker turning on the darker colors through accessibility.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even know you could do that.
Yeah, so if you go into accessibility under increased contrast, there's this new darken colors slider. And basically all it does is take the sort of the bright blue of like a lot of the labels and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and it becomes more of a darker blue. Almost,
and you really like that, huh?
For the print nerds out there, it's almost like turns it to more like process blue, if you know what that is.
Yeah, okay.
and I think it also darkens some of the icons and stuff like that. I guess some people were complaining that the icons were just too bright, like the phone icons and the things like that. So it sort of darkens the gamut a little bit.
Interesting. But that's across all the colors, right?
Across the entire phone, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
To me, what it's done, though, is when I bring it on, everything just looks richer. Mm-hmm. It looks more elegant to me for some reason. The whole UI, doesn't look so like kid-like anymore.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I didn't like about iOS 7 too. Like the shades of green and some of those brighter colors were just too, bubblegum for me.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's really nuanced. It's not a huge change, but now that I've been using it for, you know, a day, every time I pop open the phone, I'm like, oh yeah, this looks like a lot better. And I think it was in my RSS reader on my iPad, and I'm like, oh yeah, it looks much more elegant. It looks more professional.
Now, this is in accessibility, right?
Yeah, settings, accessibility. So settings, general accessibility. And,
increased contrast. Yeah, there it is.
Under increased contrast. You've got a bunch of different options there. There's also a reduced white point, but the only one I've enabled in there is the darkened colors. And it just.
Interesting. Yeah, it definitely does take those down a shade.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave that on Thanks for the tip.
Yeah, try it for a day and see what you think. But I'm not going back. And I just changed it on my iPad as well. So it's like, it's funny because these are all little things, but I think in aggregate, it really enhances the experience on iOS.
I think that's very true, especially for guys that aren't like us, you know, for
yeah, it makes it more
my
complete.
Mom, for her iPad, you know, who, when she got iOS 7, she was kind of scratching her head a little bit because it's so different than iOS 6. And I think there's a lot of really strong visual cues that they've added that make the device just easier to use for people who aren't as familiar with computers.
Yep.
And so that's a good thing for guys like us, right? We get less tech support calls.
What'd they change in the control center that you were going to mention?
I mean, it's so silly that I shouldn't even mention it. But now when you slide up the control center, it bounces a little bit.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
That's it. That's the only thing.
Before, it didn't bounce before?
No, it didn't bounce before. Oh, it weird. Just went up and stayed there. And now it does a little boing.
That's
you know?
Cool.
It's whimsical, but I think it improves. It just makes my device feel, I don't know, more personal, right?
Yeah, nice little flourishes and stuff like that.
Less
cool.
Like a computer. So my top feature for iOS 7.1.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, yep. I think I'm gonna call it a wrap. This has been awesome. It's been really great talking to you and having you on. Before we leave you,
sure.
I already mentioned you do the Cult Cast, but let everybody know where they can find the podcast, what kinds of things you're up to. I'm assuming you're going to be at Macworld. Are you speaking at Macworld by any chance?
No.
Me neither.
They're smarter than that to invite me to do that. They saw my Ignite talk.
Let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, so if you go to thecultcast.com, you'll find the podcast. I would love to have you guys come join us there as well. And you might even hear some old familiar voices, like Adam Christensen, who we need to schedule to have back on the show. And
I think
also,
at Macworld, right? We're going to do something.
Yes, we are. So We are having our first CultCast live event at Macworld in San Francisco on March 27th. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be us doing a show. We're going to do a Macworld edition show in a really nice, swanky place. It's going to be an open bar. I'm not sure if that's a good decision or not. No drink tickets. Can you imagine? It's going to be nice. The Box SF. And if you're interested, if you're going to be in San Francisco, that's the only requirement, is that you have a pulse and you'll be in San Francisco on March 27th at 8 p.m. Go to cultcast.eventbrite.com. And I think we have a handful of tickets left. They're free.
Cool.
And we would love to see you there.
Awesome.
That's it. Oh, and then I'm on Twitter at Erfon, E-R-F-O-N.
Very cool. People should follow you there.
Please do.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Erfon.
Hey, yeah. Thanks a lot. And, hopefully this went well enough that I can come back.
Anytime.
Okay.
All right. So there you go. Erfon Elijah from Cult of Mac and the Cult Cast podcast. Really should check that out. You can find it on iTunes. Had a lot of fun talking with Erfon, and I'm looking forward to seeing him next week at Macworld. And I guess I should mention that I am going to be at Macworld next week. I'm going to be covering the show for you, as I always do, trying to get around the show floor and find what's interesting and new and exciting. I'll be hanging out. If you happen to be in the area, if you're in San Francisco, probably the best thing to do is follow me on Twitter. I'll be trying to update my location and all those sorts of things, keep you up to date where I'm at. I love meeting MacCast community members when I'm at the show. So if you are out there, please don't be afraid. If you see me, I'll be running around the show floor. I have my mic with my MacCast flag on it, so you can very obviously see it's me. Check online if you want to find pictures of me, whatever. Stalk me. I don't care. It is just a blast. I love meeting people and chatting, and maybe we'll even do a couple interviews on the show, get your impressions of Macworld and what you think, and we can have you on if you're willing to do an interview and that sort of thing. So look forward to seeing you there and hearing your feedback. But that's going to do it for today's episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for your iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices. You can get more information, details, all the info on their stuff over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth simply by going to gazelle.com. MacCast.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support, for listening, for staying subscribed. Love getting your feedback, your emails, your comments, especially your audio comments. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And if you want to avoid long distance charges and you have a Skype account, you can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I've talked about on any of the episodes of the MacCast, you can find those at MacCast.com. That's the website. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. We also have a MacCast Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus, and you'll find us there. And that's about everywhere you can find me online. And that's about all I have for this episode. So until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.